accession number 11211, reel 3.
Mr. R. Malabar, Reel 3. On recovering from your wounds and ending your leave in England, Mr. Malabar, how did you get back to your battalion?
I was originally sent to a battalion of the Duke of Wellington's regiment, which was stationed somewhere in County Durham. And I was a bit anxious at this because I was anxious to get back to my own battalion, the 9th DLI. And eventually I was sent off to reinforcement holding units in France and Belgium. And I arrived back with the battalion sometime in November 1944.
What condition did you find them in?
They were static, in a static position in the Nijmegen area, in a very muddy area, and there wasn't very much going on. Although I did get a fright when I arrived there. There were three of us in a truck, and just as we were about to get out of the back of this truck in Nijmegen, there were three tremendous explosions, and we all dived off the back of the truck and landed on our faces in the mud. And we found out that these were actually anti-aircraft guns of our own that were firing at German aeroplanes, which had shown themselves. So we got muddy for nothing.
Had the battalion received any heavy losses between the time you were being wounded until you regained them?
Yes, they had been in some heavy fighting after I left them, and there were quite a few changes in the battalion.
In your own signal unit, had you lost any of your friends?
Not that I can recall. I think the signal section was just about intact at that time.
You say that the terrain was very very wet, the conditions were very wet. Can you describe them?
Well, in that particular area around Nijmegen, just everything was a sea of mud churned up by vehicles and tank trucks and tyres and feet. Of course, that was soon to change when the frosts came and the ground became frozen hard.
How did you live in those conditions?
As I say, it was pretty quiet at the time, and my recollection is of personally living on the floor of a college in a town called Galeen, and at one stage actually being billeted with a Dutch family in a town called Sittard. But I can't exactly recollect in what order that came or what happened in between. We were sort of in the line sometimes and sometimes out again in various kinds of billets and things, because this was a period of really static warfare in Holland when things really closed down for the winter.
The battalion, of course, was part of the advance towards towards Arnhem.
Yes.
Did your friends describe the particular time to you?
The main thing that sticks in my mind was my friends telling me about seeing the Germans in possession of a lot of British equipment which had been dropped to be used by our troops and by the airborne troops, and which had fallen in the wrong place, with the result that for a long time after that the Germans were using British equipment and eating British food.
Did you meet any Dutch inhabitants about this time?
Yes, I mainly came in contact with the family of the house where I was billeted in Sittard, who were not unfriendly, but perhaps not as friendly as I expected them to be. The father worked for the post office. There was the mother, a 19-year-old daughter, and a 4-year-old daughter. Now, you'd think I would get on best with the 19-year-old daughter because I was 19, but actually she wasn't too friendly. She wasn't bad, but every now and then she would say something like, make a comparison between our efficiency and that of the Americans. And on one occasion she annoyed me by, when we were talking about the Nazis, she said that the British invented concentration camps in the Boer War. But I got on well with the little girl. She tried to teach me Dutch.
Was this a general kind of opinion that the Dutch people had of British troops?
Yes, I didn't find them too friendly, and in fact, casualties were inflicted on us at various times by a Dutch SS battalion, a battalion of Dutchmen who had volunteered to fight for the Germans and were enrolled in the SS, and we hated the Dutch SS, so they were a constant topic of conversation.
Did you feel that their sympathies lay with the Germans?
To some extent, because, of course, we were near the German border, and perhaps people had relatives on the other side of the border. Certainly they weren't the ecstatic sort of people that the Belgians had been. The Belgians were really ecstatic when we arrived in places like Brussels and showered us with what gifts they could. They filled my steel helmet, for instance, with tomatoes and grapes at one stage, but that wouldn't happen among the Dutch people.
Had the 50th Division been disbanded at this time?
Yes, I should have said that when I got back to the battalion, I found that I was now a member of the 7th Armoured Division. The 50th Division had gone, and the 9th DLI had joined two other battalions to reform a new 131 Lorried Infantry Brigade of the 7th Armoured Division. So I had to take my double T divisional signs off and put the Desert Rats up.
Did you ever discover why the 9th Battalion was chosen rather than the 6th or the 8th?
I never knew. I always just presumed it was the luck of the draw. Certainly, we were very pleased to stay with a formation like the 7th Armoured Division rather than go back home, although I dare say some people might have been keen to go back home. But it was mostly the younger people who stayed behind. And we were reinforced from other battalions of 50 Div that were going back.
Did this in any way alter your role?
No. It became a different type of warfare. We now fought on wheels and tracks instead of on foot. And it would be nothing to travel 60 or 70 miles in a day going from one place to another, because the new type of warfare was that if a hole was found somewhere, we went through it and advanced as far as we could and then waited for the infantry divisions to follow us up. It was a new thing. Also, we were issued with a new to us type of radio set, which was the number 19 set, which was a very heavy set mounted on a vehicle. Because we needed much greater range with the new ranging about role that we had.
What kind of range did this set give you?
Oh, it was just about limitless. Certainly as far as we ever advanced, we never got out of touch, 50 or 60 miles, say, compared with the one that we used to carry on our backs, which was limited to about 10 miles if we were lucky.
Were there any other changes in your equipment?
No, not really, because we were still infantry, although we were called a Lorried Infantry Battalion, so we still retained the same equipment for when we had to fight on foot. But we had so many more vehicles that certainly the signallers tended to be riding about in jeeps and trucks and carriers and things more than we had before. There wasn't so much walking about.
How did your division function? There obviously would be a tank element.
Yes.
The motorized infantry. How did it function?
There was two brigades, an armoured brigade and a lorried infantry brigade. The armoured brigade consisted of a number of tank regiments, a light armoured car regiment, which was for reconnaissance, and it also had a battalion of infantry in half tracks, who were the rifle brigade, but they belonged to the armoured brigade. The lorried infantry brigade consisted of three lorried infantry regiments plus the necessary artillery and engineer support that we needed. But everybody was on wheels or tracks, and we just moved about the front quite a lot.
Do you recall who commanded the division?
General Lyne, Major General Lyne, L-Y-N-E.
Did you see him?
We thought very highly of him.
And Colonel Mogg was still in command of 9th Battalion, was he?
Yes, And the new armoured role seemed to suit him perfectly. He seemed to be the ideal commander of a motorised unit. And his well-known phrase was, crack on. Every now and then he would come along the line shouting, crack on. And I remember somebody telling, I believe it was the RSM, saying to him, Colonel, the centre line's been cut, meaning the line of our advance. Never mind, he says, crack on, bugger the centre line. We thought he was great.
Had he any other qualities which endeared him to yourselves?
Well, he was very, a very sort of fair man to deal with, and very, really very friendly. And also, he was a brave man. Before we joined the 7th Armoured Division, I remember in Normandy when we were still in 50 Div, I was crouching in my little trench. There were bullets and shells flying about, and there was an ammunition truck burning quite near to me. Colonel Mogg was walking up and down in front of my slit trench with a walking stick and saying, keep your head down, son. You'll be all right. Keep your head down, son. And he was just swinging this walking stick and walking up and down, and he's a big target. So I admired him immensely.
Where did you go to after the static situation you were in at this time?
Well, we had one or two actions while we were still there. There was one occasion when I took part in a raid with a rifle company on a farmhouse. I never found out exactly what the story was, but at the time we understood that we had to take this farmhouse and seize somebody who was inside it and bring him back. It must have been somebody very important, because it was a bigger than usual show for a company. And there were four of us signallers went with it instead of the usual one, so that they had four of us with these great 80 insets on our backs. It was in heavy snow. We started the advance, it was at night time, and as soon as we set off, our own shells began to fall among us and we began to take casualties. There was a dike in front of us, across our front, which was a ditch about 6 feet deep and about the same across, and half full of water, which was frozen, of course. So we ran forward and jumped into the dike to avoid the shells, and there we were standing waist deep in frozen water with these shells falling among us. And I was on the radio shouting, lift the stonk, lift the stonk, lift the stonk 100 yards, which was what we would say for move the barrage forward 100 yards. Somebody stuck his revolver in me and said, if you don't shut up, I'll kill you. The Jerries are just over the other side of this dike. I must have been shouting harder than usual. Anyway, the barrage did lift and moved forward. We clambered out of the dike and ran straight onto a minefield which the Germans had laid, and the snow had covered it. People started to get legs blown off, and it about 50% casualties, I would say, we took then. We gave up and we went back. I found my way back to the battalion headquarters, the only surviving signaller of the four. I put my radio set down on the ground outside the door and walked in. It was a barn, and I met the sergeant, my sergeant, who said, is your radio all right? And I'm usually a very easygoing fella, but I grabbed him by the throat and I started shouting, I'm the only one of your four signallers who's come back, and you want to know if my radio's all right. And the colonel pulled me off and gave me a cup of tea and said, it's all right, son, sit down.
So this is the state you're in when you got back?
Yes, so I was... It was anger, really. Anger to think that he was concerned about one of his damn radios being damaged, and I was the only undamaged signaller there was. The other three radios and three men had gone. On that occasion, there was one of the poor riflemen came crawling back. He was out all night, lying among these mines. And he was fired at the next morning until he started to sing Blade and Races. And a patrol went out and brought him in, but the poor fellow died. But he wasn't the only one that died that night.
Do you recall the name of your sergeant?
I wouldn't like to... slander the wrong one, but I believe it was Ernie Fones. A strange name for a signal sergeant, but there was a sergeant called Ernie Fones. There was another one called Geordie Clay, who I remember, but I'm fairly certain it was Ernie Fawns. I wasn't very pleased with him. We made friends later, though.
Do you have any idea at what time or date this was? Or the name of the place as well?
The place had a name like Iserlohn or Isenlohe, that sort of a name. And it must have been in December 44 or the very beginning of January 45. Because it was still in January when I was wounded for the second time, and it was in that area. That was when we did a battalion attack on a village called Dieteren in Holland near the German border. This was Operation Black Cock, when we were trying to clear the ground for the crossing of the Rhine. And this particular attack we had to do completely as infantry, because there was a canal immediately in front of our positions which we had to cross by using ladders and things. There were no bridges. And we had to capture this village of Dieteren and hold it until bridges could be built behind us and vehicles could come up to our support. And we set off about 8:30 in the morning. This was about the 16th of January, I believe, 1945. Thick fog, freezing cold, snow on the ground, and the whole battalion strung out, marching forward to this objective, which was about, say, 2,000 yards ahead of our positions. I was absolutely lathered, because in spite of the cold, the sweat was running off the end of my chin, because I had a woolen vest, khaki uniform, a pullover, a greatcoat, a sleeveless leather jerkin, all of my infantry equipment, because we had to carry everything with us, my great radio on my back, a balaclava helmet, a steel helmet, and my pack was slung on one side to leave room for the radio, entrenching tool hanging below my waist at the back, water bottle, bayonet, and we're moving forward, and the enemy shells started to burst among us, and I thought, quite disinterestedly, that ground's frozen quite hard, and here's me sweating like a pig, and I could see lumps of frozen soil and ice flinging up around me as these shells burst. Well, this was quite a long walk, and there's smoke and there's fog, but eventually we'll have a bit of a fight getting into the village, took a few prisoners, moved in, and the enemy ran out of the other end of the village. We decided we'd set up, I was with one of the rifle companies, we decided we'd set up company headquarters in one of these empty houses. And we went in, I put the radio on the ground, sat on it, and immediately there were some explosions outside. So I was on the floor. Then somebody told me that it was all right, it was the riflemen outside. We're using anti-personnel mines to loosen the frozen ground so they could dig their little slip trenches. Then there was a message came over the radio, tell everybody to keep quiet and listen for the sound of enemy tracked vehicles. Well, this didn't make us at all happy, because we had no tracked vehicles, no artillery. We didn't even have our anti-tank guns. We all listened, and of course we could all imagine enemy tracked vehicles moving about. But that blew over. And then the next message was, enemy machine gun teams have infiltrated behind you, and they're firing along the canal, and the engineers can't get on with the bridge building. Send a platoon back to deal with them. So I went with the platoon that was going back. And we walked back through the village, this village of Dieteren, in the snow. There was the officer in charge of the platoon in front, then me, and then the riflemen slung out behind us, all in single file, a few yards apart, still foggy, snow on the ground. Suddenly the officer throws himself to the ground. I couldn't hear a thing for the row in the headphones, so I flung myself on the ground. Everybody behind did likewise. And then he gets up again and starts walking forward, and so I get up again, cursing, because every time I dived on the ground, up came the radio back, knocked my helmet over my eyes, and it wasn't very nice. And then there was the weight of the thing on my back as I hit the ground. Down he goes again. And then he gets up again, and I get up again, and on we go again, and then down he goes again. So I lay on the ground looking at him, and I realized he was shaking. So I crawled forward to him, and I found he was shaking with laughter. I said, "What's the matter?" And he lifted his water bottle and shook it, and the ice in it made a clicking sound, just like a rifle bolt being operated, and he thought he was going to be shot every time he made a move. So he just lay there and laughed. I didn't feel like laughing, and I just had to pass the word back along the line that it was all right, and we moved on again. And we got to this canal, but by this time the machine guns must have thought better of it, because there weren't any there. So we scouted along the canal for a distance, found an enemy dugout which they'd abandoned, and in it I found two little Bakelite containers, one containing honey and one containing butter. So I thought, well, this will augment my meagre rations, and I took possession of these, and we set off again to get back to the village. And the first thing I saw was a dead German lying on the ground on his face with the top of his head sliced off like an egg, and the top of his skull was lying on the ground in front of him, still attached to the skin of his forehead. And I remember thinking that his brain looked just like a walnut inside its shell. And a little bit further on, there was this German submachine gun with its previous owner's fingers jammed in the mechanism. He must have got his fingers in the breech mechanism as he was firing, and had chopped his fingers off, and there was all blood all over it. Anyway, we're heading back into the village, and we're just in the outskirts when we hear a German mortar battery opening up. And for some reason I thought, this is for me. And I turned to face a wall on my left, dropped to my knees just as the bomb went off right behind me. And I felt such a crash on the back of my head, and my leather jerkin went red and shiny with blood. And I found that it was running down the left-hand side of my face and running off my chin just like a tap. And I was all this red, shiny blood. And my knee was just against a cellar window in this building that I was against. And I heard a voice say, "Somebody's been hit out there." I heard him yell. And this embarrassed me somewhat, because I didn't think I'd yelled, but I supposed I must have. So I got up and I found that the bomb, the blast had been taken by the back of my helmet, which was split from top to bottom down the back. My radio was full of shrapnel. My entrenching tool, which hung below the radio, was full of holes. And the soles of my boots had taken it, because I'd been on my knees, so that there wasn't really anything vulnerable except a little space under my helmet, and the shrapnel had gone through there. So I found my way to the field dressing station. I went to the regimental aid post first, and they took me to the field dressing station, which is supposed to be further back, but in this instance wasn't, because we were all in a sort of little island. And the doctor had a look at me, and he'd had a report about me from the regimental aid post. He said, "You're the fellow who's got five holes in him with one bullet." And I thought, "You're making a mistake. What do you mean, five holes with one bullet?" And he said, "Well, this thing hit you in the back of the head, came out the left-hand side of your head behind your ear, went in the back of your ear, came out of the front, that made four holes, and clipped a little bit off the little lug thing on the front of the ear, that made five holes." Which wasn't very amusing at the time, but looking back it was. And in fact, as recently as 1963, I had to go to the local hospital and have a little piece of metal removed from my neck, from the back of my head. So I was out of it again, and back to, I didn't go back to England this time, but by this time they'd got a bridge built and an ambulance had come across, so I went back in the ambulance and got on a train and went as far as Lille in France, where I was in hospital. And I was in a convalescent camp in France as well. And that was it, until I eventually got back to the battalion yet once more.
How long were you in hospital?
I was in hospital about 6 weeks again.
So the wound had been quite a nasty one?
Yes. Well, it was a number of wounds. I still have the scars, of course, on the back of my head and behind my ear. But it could have been worse. I remember lying on a stretcher on Lille railway station on the platform, and a lady of the Women's Voluntary Services turned up in her green uniform, and she looked down at me. My head was swathed in bandages. She said, "Head wound, eh? That's nasty." And stuck a cigarette in my mouth, and I don't smoke, but I just had to ignore it.
This was a military hospital.
It was the Lille General Hospital. I suppose it came under military command at that time, but it was full of nurses who were actually nuns, French nuns who were running this place. And after I'd been there and been in the operating theatre and had a bit more time in there, I then went to this hooded camp at a place called Saint-Paul, I think it was, in France, where I spent another couple of weeks convalescing, and then was fortunate enough to go back to the battalion again.
So you've been away then for about 8 weeks?
Yes, yes.
And where did you take up your connection with the battalion again? Where had they got to?
They were still in Holland. Trying to think where exactly they were. No, I'm not at all sure. I know that it was in Holland, near the German border, because it was shortly after that we crossed the Rhine. I'm not at all sure what the position was then, because there was a lot happening.
And about what time of the year did you rejoin them?
It must have been about March. Yes, it must have been about March.
Did you have a great deal of trouble with German mines?
There were a menace because being in vehicles all the time, we often had to get off the road quickly, and the Germans got into the habit of putting mines in the grass verges. They couldn't start digging the roads up to do them, but they could put them in the grass verges. And I remember one occasion when the RSM's jeep went off the road onto a verge and was blown across to the other verge and then was blown back again by another mine. So that as the Germans retreated, they did quite a lot of damage with mines.
And were they booby trapping?
Not so much at that stage. There was a good deal of booby trapping went on earlier in Normandy. On one occasion, some fellows were opening a door with a piece of rope and sheltering in a shell hole, and a booby trap went up in the shell hole. So they were pretty clever with them. But I think they didn't have so much time to mess about like that later on.
You say that you took some prisoners. What condition were they in? Did you see them?
Oh, just sort of shabby, frightened, had enough sort of prisoners. I suppose if they weren't like that, they wouldn't have been taken prisoner. Probably the best ones cleared off to fight another day. A lot of them were young boys, of course. And as we got advanced further, they got younger and younger and older until we were fighting old men and boys, really.
So you rejoined the battalion in the March, about the time that they were preparing to cross the Rhine, was that what you said?
Yes. And at that time, having had various jobs as a signaller with rifle companies and other things, at this stage I was made radio operator to the second in command, who I believe was Major Scott. During the winter, during all this static time, the jeep drivers had made a habit of building sort of saloon bodies on their jeeps out of wood and metal and all kinds of things to make them more comfortable in the bad weather. And I was going to be in one of these jeeps with the second in command and the driver. And we were having a look at this jeep, and the major said to me, "Is there anything you want altering on the jeep?" And I said, "Yes, I want all that top off." And the driver went mad. He'd spent a long time building this beautiful saloon body, and I thought that he was going to insist on keeping it. Major insisted on it coming off. He said, if he wants it off, it's coming off. Because I'd had experience of being fired on in vehicles, and I wanted to be able to roll off the back or off the side as soon as it happened. And as it happened, I was glad later on that I had done this when I did have occasion to roll off because we were being fired at. But this was a different type of job to what I'd usually done, because the second-in-command's role seemed to be constantly to be probing ahead once the battalion was mobile, trying to find the best way through places, so that we often were fired at and got into trouble a few times. There was one occasion when there was a tank on another side, an enemy tank on the other side of a railway embankment, who fortunately couldn't get his gun down low enough, and we just fled away along the side of the embankment. And when we came to a tunnel through the embankment, it was too small for the tank to get through, so we escaped.
So your role altered in that you were really at the front.
Yes, I wasn't with a company or with any of the other subunits or anything. I was I spent my time in this jeep, riding about with the major, sort of calling back what was the best thing to do under any given circumstances. I believe Major Scott was wounded about this time, because there was one occasion when we came to a town called Statlone, where we managed to squeeze through the side of a tank. The Germans had invented a kind of a tank barrier which consisted of a huge roller made of wood and filled with rubble, which they rolled across the road between two fence things. And we managed to squeeze through this by the side of this tank obstacle thing. And Statlone consisted of two streets, and the whole town was destroyed except for the church tower. And if I'm not mistaken, the adjutant was in the jeep to replace the second in command. And there was the driver and me in the back with my radio. We had these new 19 sets that I spoke of, bolted into the back of the jeep. And we raced down one street, got to the far end of the town, turned round, and were coming back up the other street, making sure it was clear, when a machine gun opened up on us from the church tower, which was the only building standing. Hit the jeep, hit the driver.